Hello, and welcome to the Bristol History Podcast with me, Tom Brothwell. The Bristol History Podcast is brought to you in partnership with the Bristol Cable. The Bristol Cable is the city's media cooperative, owned and created by local people. This week, I spoke with Roger Ball and Mark Steeds, author of a major new history entitled From Wolfston to Colston, Severing the Sinews of Slavery in Bristol, which was published by the Bristol Radical History Group in June of this year. At over 400 pages, the book traces the history of Bristol's involvement in the slave trade for over 1,000 years. From the Anglo-Saxon Bishop of Worcester, St. Wolfston, who was able to end the slave trade between Bristol and Ireland in the 11th century, through to the rise of Bristol's powerful merchant class, who both drove and profited from the transatlantic slave trade. True to the spirit of other Bristol Radical History Group works, the book seeks to challenge traditional narratives around slavery and its abolition. Abolition is not portrayed simply as the work of a few white male saints, William Wilberforce and his ilk. Instead, more attention is paid to the significance of slave rebellions in the colonies, especially in Jamaica and Haiti, which changed material conditions on the ground and forced the pace of abolition. Also, the crucial work of many women, such as Elizabeth Blackwell, Mary Carpenter, Mary Estlin, Elizabeth Hayrick, long overlooked, is given the prominence it deserves. And popular grassroots abolition movements are taken seriously, challenging the narrative that British public opinion was united in its support for slavery. In short, the book seeks to put gender, race, and class into the story of slavery and abolition. I began by asking about how the idea for the book came about. Mark Steeds answered first, and Roger Ball is the voice you hear after his.
Well, I've been commissioned to do a Wolfston book by BRHG for many, many years, and I was moaning to Rog about the lack of memorialisation of Wolfston and the fact that perhaps the Colston Hall could do with a new name, and Wolfston Hall might fit the bill.
Basically, Mark was working on Wolfston and I was working on Colston. So the idea was that Mark would originally produce a booklet on St. Wolfston because we felt that history was really unknown, well, not known popularly. And then, well, 2014 was when the bishop, famously at the Charter Day to all the school children, you know, the Society of Merchant Venturers Charter Day, famously said, you know, where they was going on about how Colston was a great man, and then said, and there's speculation around his business interests, and it's just speculation, which was filmed secretly by a journalist who got into the service. And then that was put out on YouTube, and it caused all this trouble because obviously people were saying, the Bishop of Bristol is saying that Colston really wasn't involved in the slave trade. So then one of the people who was involved in that came to Bristol Radical History Group and said, can you have a look into Colston? Because we're going to make a complaint to the Church of England about priests telling lies or making falsities. So I got involved in looking into Colston at the same time.
Which they're still doing, by the way.
Which we're still working on. So I was working on Colston and Mark was working on Wolfston. I didn't envisage writing anything at that stage. I was just going through all the sources.
But things were happening and it became apparent there was a huge lack of general knowledge to the whole topic. A lot of falsehoods have been put about, and it just seemed to us that something was needed to try and put some clarity on the whole issue, really.
I think also that when you start looking at all the secondary sources, so what we should say really is it wasn't planned in the form that it is now. It started as two separate pieces of research, and then Mark started to say, right, let's think about linking them.
Yeah, it evolved, really. It was an evolution more than anything else.
So part of the reason is when you look at, when you pull out all the secondary sources on slavery, we noticed that they were, you know, really spread around. So though you say this book's been written about slavery in Bristol, I mean, there are things like Slavery Obscured by Madge Dresser, which is a really good social history. That book was out of print by 2016, and unfortunately, Madge gave it over to Bloomsbury Press. They reproduced it at like 90 quid or something. So a book that was like 12 or 14 quid and accessible became inaccessible. So that's one thing. But also a lot of the sources were spread out, you know, like pamphlets that were out of print, you know, Bristol Historical Association, all sorts of stuff around Bristol. So it was spread out and fragmented and not really available. So
it never ever came together, really.
No.
Prior to what we've done, you've never had a sort of coming together of all the histories, really.
Yeah.
Part of it is that it's a resource, right? Because, I mean, as someone who's done these podcasts and, you know, we've done ones on slavery or bits that touched on it, you think, oh, where's this Bible on this stuff? Where do I go to? And there's a little bit here and a little bit there. And like you say, some stuff is out of print. There's good stuff online, but it's sort of here and there. And it seems like it really married up very well for you in that you've got history covering a thousand years, but there's a struggle against slavery and then there's people on the other side who are organising it and promoting it and making money from it. And that's quite a powerful narrative throughout the book.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think I know Mark had a few bugbears he's going to talk about in a minute about how the abolition movement had been presented. But I think you're right. I mean, I think one thing that I always had a problem with was this idea that, which was certainly propagated by the merchant venturers, and you'll notice that in the book we draw reference to it, is this all idea that we're all in it together. So the way that the merchant venturers, for example, in 2007, at the bicentenary of the abolition of the slave trade, Darcy Parks of the merchant venturers said, oh, you know, we're all in it together. And in fact,
we're all culpable. That was it.
Yeah. Bristol, you know, it was all Bristol was at it, you know, and all this. And also the idea that they almost took a race line on it, which is really interesting, that it was basically, oh, wasn't it terrible, racism? And, you know, white people, it was white versus black people, and all the white people were in it together in Bristol. That's somewhat ridiculous to say that.
Patently not true.
But and that's why there was a big argument in 2006, because there was a meeting of a public meeting at the Arnold Feeney, I believe, where there was a bunch of academics and they debated this issue, which was presented on Points West at the time on TV as, should Bristol apologise for slavery? And I remember watching it with a couple of the people from the Radical History Group, including one of the founders at the time. And she was looking at it and we were pulling our hair out watching it on Points West, because what happened was they portrayed it as this bunch of intellectuals and talking about, should Bristol apologise for slavery? And then they said, they took a vote in the room, and 90% of the audience said, yes, Bristol should apologise for slavery. And then Points West said, but we went out on the streets of Bristol and asked people, should Bristol apologise for slavery? And of course, 90% said no. Now, the reason they said no was obvious. It's like, well, what do you mean I should apologise for slavery? I didn't do it.
If they'd asked about the merchant venturers, then that's an entirely different thing.
But in fact, that was distorted, because what actually happened in the meeting was they didn't ask that question. Somebody said, should Bristol apologise for slavery? And apparently somebody in the meeting said, no, should the merchant venturers apologise for slavery? And 90% of the meeting voted yes. So it was a problem of, you know, is all Bristol involved?
The Society of Merchant Venturers crops up frequently in the book, and it's certainly worth exploring in greater detail. Evolving out of a merchant's guild in the 13th century, the organisation was instrumental in the exploration, and then the exploitation, of West Africa and the Americas. The Society of Merchant Venturers was involved in successfully lobbying to break London's monopoly in trading enslaved Africans. This led to Bristol and other English ports being able to officially trade in slaves from 1698. There was significant crossover in terms of membership of the Society of Merchant Venturers and the political elite who ran the Bristol Corporation. Indeed, it was not always easy to tell the difference between the memberships and interests of the two. In the Victorian period, the Society and its membership helped to fund many large-scale engineering projects, including the Clifton Suspension Bridge and the Great Western Railway. The ambit of the Society is wide-ranging, and it was involved in founding and funding many of Bristol's most prominent charitable and educational institutions, including Colston School, Colston Girls, and Merchants Academy. Nowadays, the Society of Merchant Venturers continues to run as a charity and as a charitable trust, and, not uncontroversially, the Society retains an influence within the city. We've mentioned Wolfston, and maybe it's good to talk a little bit about him, because as you say, he's not as well known perhaps as he should be, or maybe as you would like him to be. And I think that's something else you're trying to do in the book, right, is row back against the people who have been, I think you say in your introduction, over-memorialised, like Abbott, Colston and Brunel. So are you able to talk a bit as to who Wolfston was and why you think he's worthy of memorialisation, or why he's worthy to be better known?
Well, he needs to be known because it sort of states the case going way back that there were people against the trade. And what he achieved was, in 1090, he did get the slave trade between Bristol and Dublin banned. They did get a popular rising from the first recorded rising of the Bristol mob. They did take out the most nefarious slave trader who persisted in carrying on with the practice, and they took his eyes out. You know, there was a lot of feeling from ordinary people, and no one knows the story. It needs to be told.
And also, you might ask yourself, we've considered this question about why is Wolfston, you know, really doesn't appear anywhere. And you'd think to yourself, well, you know, it's very surprising that he doesn't appear in anything in Bristol, really. I mean, there are, you know, some exceptions outside.
Yeah, out in Westbury, yeah. Where he did build Westbury Church. But actually, in the heart of the city, where he went amongst the slave pens, there's nothing. And you think, well, why is that? What's stopping this bit of narrative from coming out?
And also, you start to think, well, I can see why that might not have happened. Because obviously there's certain periods, you know, religious schisms, you know, Protestant and Catholic Catholicism and all that. So they probably had a part to play, no doubt. But you also ask yourself, well, perhaps it wasn't popular in the 18th century or even the 19th century to celebrate somebody who was against slavery in a city where the ruling class has dominated and made a lot of money out of slavery. So they're not going to exactly be, you know, fating abolitionists, are they?
And this trade was a trade between, like you said, mainly Bristol and Ireland back in the 11th century.
Yeah, what they were doing, they were feeding the Viking Empire. Dublin was the epicentre, or the biggest slave mart, if you like, for the Viking kingdom. And they were taking enslaved people, or kidnapped people, or people down on their luck. They were taking them from Bristol, and they were taking them from Chester, other points within England and around Western Europe, centralising them on Dublin and then redistributing them throughout the Viking Empire, which was pretty darn huge in its day.
Edward Colston is a central figure in the book. Born in 1636 and living a long life until 1721, the authors marshal a large amount of historical evidence to show that Colston's involvement in the transatlantic slave trade was both prolonged and profound. The book also examines how, some 150 years after Colston's death, his memory was reshaped as part of a concerted project of celebration by the merchant elite in Victorian Bristol. Edward Colston the slave trader became Edward Colston the merchant philanthropist. Indeed, it was a society of merchant venturers who organised the construction of Colston's statue, which stood from 1895 until it was forcibly removed by protesters during the Black Lives Matter protests in June of this year.
And maybe we can move on to talking a bit about Colston then, because he does have his own chapter in the book. You've gone a huge amount of way to putting in a lot of detail about his life, and in the appendices as well, there's a lot of detail there, because it seems like that position that he not only profited from the slave trade, but helped as a major organiser of the slave trade, is something that still needs to be established. And is that fair to say you're kind of seeking to make that clear beyond all doubt in the book?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, the book is not as comprehensive as some of the work made publicly available on the Radical History Group website, these sort of discussion research papers. But the key thing for me was when I first started looking into him, I mean, I knew a little bit about him, but it's always good to look back and think about what your popular memory of somebody was when you started. So when I started, my idea of Colston and what I'd been told or perhaps read here and there was that he was just an investor. I've always had a problem with this idea of, you know, he made money out of it, because it's kind of weak in one level, because it tends to be, it's a bit like saying, oh, well, we've discovered that the Church of England have been investing in British aerospace systems or something. And oh dear, they didn't realise they were investing in, you know, weapons. In weapons or something. You know, that's, So it's always a bit, oh dear, he didn't realise, you know. So that's the way Colston was kind of presented as an investor. But when I actually looked, I was like, bloody hell. I was like, hang on a minute. He was second in command of the Royal African Company. It's like, hang on a minute. This is not just somebody who invested. I mean, the fact that he was a major investor, he was in the top 5% in the actual company at the time. You know, that was something we discovered. I mean, weird things had gone on. You know, this information had been around for 100 years because of the Wilkins book. And we must point out that a lot of the stuff in the book, and a couple of names I want to mention, obviously the Reverend H.J. Wilkins in his book in 1920, which exposed, he did a hell of a lot of the real legwork. I mean, I haven't been diving into all the primary sources anywhere near as much as Wilkins did. He did a brilliant job just going through our Royal African Company documentation. The other person we briefly want to mention is Spencer Jordan, who's an academic, you know, who we've borrowed from a lot. And I've got to say his name because his work on Colston, the reinvention of Colston in the Victorian period, is that's where that comes from. He's done a brilliant bit of work there. But anyway, yeah, back to Colston. Yeah, it was amazing. When I actually looked and went, oh, he's actually not, he wasn't just an investor. He was involved for 12 years in organising it, you know, at centre. And I think why we made a Colston chapter is really you can draw a dividing line in the transatlantic slavery between the early period when it's a monopoly, you know, 1698, and then the period after that, arguably in Bristol up to 1807. You can say there are these two different phases, and that fight over the monopoly is really important. And Colston is a very interesting figure because he's obviously directly involved in the monopoly, which is why we can say he was a leading organizer of slavery in the 17th century, because he was. And he was in the top, in this one company, and he's in the top 24 board of directors, effectively, and he's, you know, second in command for 2 years. So, you know, he's central to that story, but also he's a member of the Merchant Venturers at the same time. Why that's really interesting is, of course, the Merchant Venturers are fighting tooth and nail with loads of other merchants around the country to break that monopoly. Colston sits in both organisations at the same time. And when we first started, I couldn't get over that. It was a bit like being in the pro-Brexit and anti-Brexit campaigns, yes and no, at the same time. So how could you do that? Now, you know, Colston changes sides eventually. He leaves the Royal African Company in 1692 and ends up, you know, the other end of it with all these interloping merchants and people who are making fortunes in Bristol. And so we always wondered, why was he fated? Because on paper, there's no way the Merchant Venturers would have fated him, because he was in the organisation that had the monopoly.
As Roger and Mark have pointed out, Colston began his involvement in the slave trade by becoming a member of the Royal African Company in 1680. This London-based institution was, until 1698, the only British organisation officially allowed to trade in enslaved people. However, by the mid-1690s, it appears Colston had switched his allegiance and he became an influential voice in lobbying to end London's monopoly on the slave trade and argued for opening it up to other British cities, especially Bristol. In 1711, he was involved in taking subscriptions to the founding of a new organisation, the South Sea Company. This company had a monopoly on the trading of slaves to Spanish colonies in South America and the South Pacific. The company collapsed in 1720, causing a national scandal at the time, but not before it had transported an estimated 34,000 slaves.
So if you want to characterise the new history or the history that wasn't written about, I think the South Sea Company is really important because we exposed that. And why that was an important piece of history is there was this kind of urban myth about Colston that he'd sort of done slavery, okay, he made some money out of it, and then he got better, and he had a kind of epiphany.
And suddenly gave it away to his schools.
Yeah, and he was a philanthropist. He suddenly realised, and some people characterise that, he kind of got over slavery, realised it was bad, and then he was good again. But the problem was, of course, no, he went straight back into the slave trade in South Sea Company. And nobody had ever picked up on that. And there were other things that were really strange were, I always got told, you can't find out about how much money Colston made out of slavery because you can't get, the ledgers don't exist, the information's not there. But when I looked at the Wilkins book, I was able to back calculate from the dividends what his investments were in the Royal African Company. It was easy. easy, you know. It was like, what? This is not rocket science. This is just no one's bothered to really look because no one wants to look.
Also, you can see through, thanks to Wilkins, you can see how he was groomed for it. He went to Blue Coat School in London, one of the top schools. He went to one of the livery companies, the main livery company, yeah. The Mercer company. He went then to the Iberian coast as a mere merchant, as they call them. And he was groomed for every possible useful connection he could ever have in order to then go and exploit the African slave trade.
This is why we're still working on some of this stuff, because there are numerous ways of making money out of the slave trade if you're in the Royal African Company. And you'll see in the book how he kind of characterised him. He was lending money to the Royal African Company. He was taking dividends and shares and all that sort of thing. He was also supplying commodities. I mean, you could make money. If you were in the Royal African Company and you had that kind of trading family background, you could make a lot of money because there were so many ways of making that money. Insider trading was normal.
So. And on top of that, Wilkins identified the power of the purse. And this was something Colston really liked to do. Like, he lent money to Bristol Corporation and then wanted it back again at a very inconvenient time. He was always dictating who went into his school, who didn't go into his school. You know, unless someone was high Anglican, you know, nonconformist, don't you come to our school, you know. Catholics, well, you can just run away, you know. He was very, very bigoted. And he used his money in order to influence what he...
Yeah.
And do you think that kind of personal power that he built up was part of the reason that you then got this cult of Colston, which, you know, is a Victorian invention? I'm interested as to why he was a sort of good candidate for being lionized in the way that he was.
There is this idea that he was like humble, and people don't know any idea. I've got no idea sources for this information, right? His idea was humble. He didn't want to propagate his name.
That's exactly right, because what he did with his, you know, he had a very grand funeral. He then dictated that he wanted a huge great tablet at the back of his tomb in All Saints Church with every possible generous thing that he did chiseled onto it. You know?
The important point is to say that although he was from Bristol, he spent very little time in his life in Bristol. And there's reasons for that, because you can't run the slave trade from Bristol if you've got to live in London. You know, it
was to perpetuate his memory again, though, he had all these societies. He had the Anchor Society, the Dolphin Society, the Colston Society, and the Grateful Society of all things, the poor buggers who went to his school.
But I think that, so there were societies that propagated his name in the 18th century. But what Spencer Jordan did that was so interesting was to try and understand why he got reinvented in that mid-Victorian period or mid to late Victorian period. Because we found a really interesting source around 1850, I believe it is, where somebody says, oh, Colston wasn't that well known as a philanthropist till recently. So there's some interesting evidence there, which is saying that by the mid-19th century, he'd be kind of a bit forgotten.
There was a resurgence, definitely.
A resurgence, and Jordan argues that, you know, this is this period of the rejuvenation, or the idea of the great man philanthropist, Victorian philanthropist. So there's people who want to be those philanthropists, and they want to create icons from history. Now, I mean, Jordan argues this really interesting point that he fulfilled two supposed categories that those people wanted to champion. One was, you know, giving to charity. So they create this idea of the moral saint. The other side to it is, of course, that they are, you know, international traders and businessmen. Many of them have families or were directly involved in slavery and the slave trade. So they need the merchant prince. You know, they are the merchant venturers. So he fulfills that because he's an international trader. You know, I mean, admittedly, they're not shooting their mouths off about slavery. They just talk about West Indian trade or something, you know. But so he fulfills these two angles, the idea of the international merchant, now business class, you know, an international trader, and along with, you know, this idea of the philanthropist. And so they recreate Colston as being that icon. But what I think is so interesting about it is that it wasn't, the statues and things like that come quite late, and a lot of the stuff starts to appear. But I think the most important thing, and also central to understanding groups like Countering Colston, was that this was about ritual and commemoration and celebration, physical ceremonies. And in the description in the book, I think of Colston Day, you know, on the 13th of November each year in sort of the late Victorian period is very interesting. It's ritual, you know, you've got these marches of apprentices, you've got all these banquets, you've got, and it builds up over a couple of weeks, you know, and they give everybody a day off, you know? And then all the newspapers are full of these stories, you know, these kind of semi-religious things, you know, like, oh God, when we opened his tomb, he was miraculously preserved, yeah. You know, oh God, he's Jesus, you know. And then it's like, well, in fact, it turns out it was probably some bloke. It was some bloke. It wasn't even Colston, apparently. But and then, you know, the dolphin story, and then, the story of him giving out alms. And they would repeat all these stories in the press. And that's what rebuilt or created what most people in the 20th century knew about Colston.
Yeah, but into the 21st century, you still got these starveling buns, you know, the Colston buns.
Well, they still have the ceremonies going.
You've still got the chrysanthemums. Yeah. It's bizarre.
I mean, you know, when this is what Country Colston was all about. It wasn't interested in stained glass windows and statues or anything like that. Country Colston started because school children were being forced to go down to these big ceremonies and listen what a great bloke this slave trader was.
And he's never told that they were never told that he was a slave trader. I mean, in fact, that was the frustrating thing. Yeah. Not many commentators on the story ever asked where he got his money from. It was only Wilkins a bit later on, and then Derek Robinson in the 1970s who suddenly thought, where did this come from? You know, how could he do these things?
So clearly what happened in the Victorian period survived. I mean, it definitely lessened, and it's, you know, and Colston Day disappeared in 1901, I think. So it definitely lessened, but it remained. And it was it was very much attached to the institutions, though, wasn't it? It was attached to Merchant Venturers. It was attached to Colston School, Colston Girls School, Redcliffe and Temple School,
St. Mary Redcliffe, St. Stephen's, Bristol Cathedral,
St. Bristol, All Saints, and all that. So, you know, not in 2016, you know, to stand there and watch the Merchant Venturers marching to St. Stephen's
with their top hats
on. With all their top hats on and stuff, it was really weird to see that stuff was still going on, you know, and you know, effectively their man, their icon is Mr. Colston. So I think it's really important that people misunderstand. Lots of people wanted to pin stuff on Karen Colston. Like, oh, you wanted to take the statue down. No, we didn't. We started with these concrete celebrations. And that's what we hope to bring out in the book, is the fact that they had a history. And even more interesting, that was arguably what we might call a fake tradition.
To change tack a little bit, something else that you talk about quite a lot in the book, and I see this again as maybe a correcting narrative, is talking about enslaved people's resistance. You've got a large appendix, which is quite chilling, to be honest, the African resistance on ships, where you have the numbers of enslaved people who were embarked on these voyages and then disembarked, and you know, there's obviously often big discrepancies there.
No, you're absolutely right. It is staggering that African resistance is not mentioned, and it played a huge part. In fact, the reason compensation was doled out in the end in the 1830s was because the authorities knew that sooner or later there would be so much resistance they wouldn't be able to keep a cap on it and carry on as they are.
Yeah, I mean, I think we weren't doing it because we were trying to be like, I don't know, modern or something. You know, the fact of the matter is that if you don't look at certainly the major revolutions and insurrections, you know, Haiti in the late 18th century and particularly Sam Sharpe's rebellion in Jamaica, if you don't look at them, then there's a huge omission from history. One of the things that I find incredible is the fact that nobody has a knowledge of the Caribbean campaign by the British Army and Navy in the 1790s, the attempt to re-establish slavery in San Domingo and Haiti, and the importance of that.
The loss of life.
I mean, you know, I said 3,500 people died at Battle of Waterloo, 50,000 people died in that campaign. Nobody knows about it. It doesn't even appear on regimental banners. And these things were absolutely vital. You know, it's a huge geopolitical battleground. So we wanted to put them in.
The book draws attention to the actions of enslaved people in themselves bringing about the end of slavery. The events in Haiti, then a French colony known as Saint-Domingue, at the end of the 18th century, are extremely important to the story. Following the French Revolution of 1789 and the promulgation of Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité, there were those who realised that this assertion of natural human rights was not limited to white people. Rebellion of the Enslaved, led by Toussaint Louverture, began in 1791, and by 1798, he was in full control of Haiti. This was despite a mass mobilisation of naval power by the British, who were attempting to capitalise on the French Revolution by taking control of French colonial possessions, and also attempting to bring what the British called security to the region. In the book, the commander of the British operations is reported as wanting to, quote, prevent a circulation in the British colonies of the wild and pernicious doctrines of liberty and equality. The failure of the British to capture Haiti, to stem revolt, and the huge human and financial cost that Roger has mentioned undoubtedly furthered the course of abolition inside the British establishment, in this case providing practical, rather than what we might call moral, reasons for abolition. While there was slavery, there would always be slave rebellions, and the Caribbean campaign of the 1790s had shown the British that they could by no means be confident of keeping things in hand. The slave rebellion in Jamaica in 1831, led by the Baptist Sam Sharp, was a case in point. Up to 60,000 enslaved people, who were hopeful and expectant of an emancipation edict coming from London, were mobilised to strike against slavery on Christmas Day. Repressions led to violent conflict and massive damage to the island's plantations. Although the rebellion was eventually suppressed, Caribbean historian Richard Hart claims that the rebellion was, quote, a sure indication that if slavery was not soon abolished from above, it would be destroyed from below.
We picked up on the, you know, the fact that there was resistance. And I was amazed by a figure that was being touted by some academics of 1 in 10 voyages had some kind of unrest on enslaved ships, or 1 in 10. And then just to look at that and to start understand why it was so difficult to actually revolt on ships and how difficult it was, all that stuff is really interesting. And the fact that we could relate that to Bristol ships, to people who really were, you know, we put some names on it. That was part of that. A lot of that comes from the Slave Voyages database, which is an amazing resource. Certainly, I always say to people, go and have a look at it. But I think that's one thing. But it's also to put everyday resistance in there. And things like no idea about, for example, there was massive resistance across the Caribbean with the apprenticeship scheme. The fact that slavery doesn't end in 1834. You know, it carries on, was going to carry on for another six to eight years.
Yeah.
And there's huge resistance there. And nobody knows, there was very little knowledge about that. So what we've tried to do is put the history in because it's very important in the abolition. But it's also to put in these big gaps, because some people do know about slave revolts. What they didn't know about was that they carried on after the end of, supposedly.
Well, one of the things that intrigued me was that you had the reform riots in Bristol in October 1831. It was only a couple of months later you had the Christmas Rebellion in Jamaica, led by Sam Sharp, and it was quite a juxtaposition. And we also got a window on what your ordinary person in the street felt.
Yeah.
With Henry Hetherington and James Ackland, you know, these people were writing about ordinary fellows. They were having rallies on Brandon Hill and stuff like that. And, you know, there are newspaper reports we've been able to cull and get information on them. Yeah.
I know one of Mark's bugbears before he started this project was that Madge Dresser had written, I'll misquote her. Madge is my mate, don't worry about it. But Madge Dresser had written that, you know, that abolitionists in Bristol were what, few and far?
Precious few abolitionists.
And there was this impression that, you know, that was given that the abolition movement was a bunch of nice middle class or posh people who were Christians who felt bad or something. But when you actually look at the history, you find, no, hang on a minute. That's not the case. In fact, at different phases, it was a mass popular movement. And that's why this whole thing about we were all in it together doesn't hold water. They managed to get petitions that today would be the equivalent of getting, you know, sort of 20 million people to sign a piece of paper, the equivalent. You know, I mean, a huge numbers of people in Britain, you know. And then also you see we found all these really interesting ideas. So I was always told things like James Ackland, who was a radical reformer, he was involved in the Bristolian in the 1820s, late 1820s. You know, I was always told it was just James Ackland and this newspaper. But then you start finding reports of like thousands of people in these meetings. You know, quote, ragtag and bobtail of Bristol. Well, that ragtag and bobtail of Bristol, two years later, was burning the houses of the wealthy, destroying all the jails in the 1831 reform riots. So you can't, these people were not individuals. They were movements. And Adam Hochschild's book, Bury the Chains, exposed that to us.
That was a great inspiration.
The fact that these were popular movements. And we've uncovered a lot more since then. So I think two of the most amazing things were to see, first of all, people saying that the slave owners should not get compensation, and secondly, that the slaves should. Lots of people talk about reparations today and have no idea that people were talking about that in the 1820s and 30s. You know, that's one thing that's really, really important. The fact that that was on the agenda in mass meetings is just very, very interesting. It wasn't just this kind of, we're all in it together again. You know, it's people are making fundamental demands. I think the other thing that was really interesting to us was finding out about Elizabeth Hayrick. You know, there's a lot of women activists. You know, there's obviously been a turn towards, you know, understanding women and abolition movement. You know, there's been a lot done over the last 20 or 30 years. But what was so interesting about Hayrick is, I mean, no disrespect to abolition movement, but you sometimes have to look at the texts, the political tracts that changed courses of political thought. And Hayrick's tract turns the abolition movement in the 1820s from
a gradual amelioration,
almost with ideas, almost like a neoliberal withering away, which you've got Edmund Burke, you know, and all this nonsense, you know, the slavery will wither away, and, you know, your Wilberforce going, I think they'll be nice and give up on it, you know, these slave owners. And then you've got Hayrick comes along and just blows all this out of the water. And not only in Britain.
Immediacy, that's what we need. We need it now.
We need it right now. And she says, and her influence is not just in Britain or in the Empire, British Empire. Her influence is in the United States as well. So this woman, who's never been memorialized properly, you know, writes a tract, you know, against gradualism, which is fundamental in shifting everything. Probably may have brought the abolition forward by 20 years or something straight away, just by putting that on the agenda. So she's a hero of ours.
Leicester-born social reformer Elizabeth Hayrick was a founding member of the Anti-Slavery Society, which came into being in 1823. As Roger and Mark have said, she was opposed to the gradualist approach taken by prominent figures in the group, such as William Wilberforce and Thomas Clarkson, who argued that the actual practice of slavery would gradually die out following the abolition of the slave trade in 1807. Note that it was only the trading of slaves and not slavery itself that was outlawed by the British in 1807. Frustrated by the slow pace of change, Hayrick published her influential pamphlet, Immediate Not Gradual Abolition, in 1824, which attacked gradualism as, quote, the very masterpiece of satanic policy. She also said, quote, the West Indian planters have occupied too prominent a place in the discussion of this great question. The abolitionists have shown a great deal too much politeness and accommodation towards these gentlemen. As Roger and Mark have said, the effect of her widely circulated pamphlet was to help shift both the position of the Anti-Slavery Society and debate within wider society away from gradualism and towards demand for complete and immediate abolition. Unfortunately, Elizabeth Hayrick died in October 1831 and didn't live to see the passing of the Slavery Abolition Act in 1833.
And do you think that's a simple case of gender being a case here as to why she's overlooked, or because she didn't fit in with that narrative? As you say, in terms of these narratives you're challenging, there is that abolition narrative, which in some cases is even crystallised in one person of Wilberforce, you know, the kind of saintly Wilberforce ending. Is that
a combination of those factors? But there's Bristol women as well who need their place in the sun, and they've been overlooked basically. We're talking Elizabeth Blackwell, Mary Carpenter, Mary Astin. They're great women, and you won't find, this is the really bad thing about Bristol's memorial landscape, you won't find any women bar Queen Victoria on a pedestal in Bristol, and that's shocking.
We've tried to show the disagreements in the movement, and I think one of the things we've learned, I mean, if we take from our own experience, when we went out and protested in 2015 and 2016, you know, there were very small groups of us, like 6 or 8, 10 people going out and protesting, and we were considered to be crazies. It's changed so much now, but 3 years ago, if you'd have said, I want that statue down, you had to say it in whispered tones. You know, it was like, it wasn't on the agenda at all. It was like, you're crazy if you think that. And people used to whisper to us in the museum service. I know people, I won't name them because they still have to be careful, who said things like, what's this about putting in a museum? They should fucking throw it in the dock. You know, these are people who work in these places and they hate these things. I'm talking about people who work in the Bristol Museum Service. And lots of people now have jumped on the bandwagon about this and saying, oh yes, I always thought the statue should come down. Well, that's complete nonsense. So the point about this is you do have to look at what were considered the radical and crazy elements of the abolition movement in the 1820s or in the 1790s, right? And say, well, they were the ones who eventually their agenda hit, you know, was the one that is what happened.
The basic problem,
they were seen as crazy.
Yeah. Basic problem with Bristol is the can's been kicked down the road perpetually since the Festival of the Sea in 1996. You had a glimmer of hope with a respectable trade exhibition in 1999. You had a big chance to do something with Abolition 200. It was completely wasted. And then subsequently, you've had round tables, you've had legacy meetings, yeah. And now we've got a commission. When is finally something going to happen where something tangible is on the ground that people can address this whole issue?
Yeah. Where's the memorial to the victims of the transatlantic slave trade? Why is it not there? That's what we've been saying this for nearly 20 years.
Golden opportunities, left, right in Chelsea, to put something right in the heart of where it happened, you know, where this history happened, and it's just been ignored.
Yeah, and that is with first elected black mayor in the country. Amongst some of the activists, there's this sort of cynical laughter and bitterness about the fact that now things have moved on a little bit in the great Bristol crowd sense. Now they're saying, oh, yeah, but they're still not doing anything. They're still talking about commissions and round tables. And, you know, to be honest, we're sick of it all. We're bored of it. You know, it's like, well, lots of people have done the history now and they've done it without being paid. I mean, no disrespect to the academics, but I mean, they kept it in the academia, really. And over the years, many people have gone out and done stuff and not been paid to do it.
That's correct. Yeah.
And have pushed for memorials, all sorts of stuff, and you're still fighting now to get something. So I think the point about the book, in a way, is to say you mustn't underestimate the radicals. What was so interesting was the radicals weren't alone, whether it was St. Wolfston, whether it was Coleridge and Southey and all these people, and Clarkson,
the literati, in the 1690s,
and then if you go into the 1820s and you look around, you see these radicals and they're saying things which are popular, but they're not popular amongst the ruling elite at all. We found evidence that it wasn't just that there was a few radicals, it was the fact these few radicals could pull people out for meetings. And it's very interesting, that period in 1812 to about 1814, when there are mass public meetings in support of the abolition of slave trade, I mean, in terms of extending the abolition of slave trade across the Atlantic.
I asked Roger and Mark about what kind of reception the book had received since being published.
It was quite funny. We got the delivery of the books on the Friday. We were on Radio Bristol on the Saturday. And then on the Sunday, Mr. Splashy goes in. And then within 3 weeks, we'd sold 300 books. Yeah. Well, pleased. Thank you.
Yeah, so people, one of our mates, who's a publisher, Richard, at Tangier Books, spread a rumour that we were offering free books to anybody who pulled the statue down. But it was just complete coincidence. I mean, I actually put it on the, when I wrote the first article on the Sunday evening after, because I was down there when it happened, And I wrote the article and I was like, for all you conspiracy theorists out there, like, no, it's just a coincidence that we got with the palette arrived on Friday. So yeah, it did help a bit pulling, you know, going for Coles to go for a swim definitely helped. I'm glad you picked up on it being a source book, because the point about it is that, you know, mostly we're working from secondary sources, obviously. I mean, you know, try and do 1,000 years of history using primary sources, you'll be there forever. So that's the first point, is it was never planned to be, you know, sort of take on certain academics or anything like that. But what it was there for is to say, go and have a look. You know, that's the whole point, is to pick this book up. I mean, for example, why not pick the book up and go, I'm going to go and look at this slave ship. What's the history of this ship? You know, and these people owned it that had a revolt on it. What happened in the revolt? You know, the whole idea of the book is to open it up and say, go and investigate, you know, because you can do the detailed micro histories then, which are, you know, will expose more things and be very interesting.
There's 800 references in there, and we're very proud of those 800 references, and they took a lot of doing.
I'd also like to say, I think the other thing is, it's not just about doing history. You know, as far as we're concerned, you know, what Bristol really lacks is a concrete memorial and museum to deal with, you know, in the kind of scale that
It needs an international one. I mean, Bristol was the primary slave port during the takeoff of Britain's involvement in the slave trade. Britain became the preeminent slave trader in the world, just as Bristol was peaking before Liverpool took over.
So we need something concrete, and you know, we need something on the scale of what's done in Nantes in France or in Liverpool. Yeah. That's what we're after.
Hugely important.
Many thanks to Roger Ball and to Mark Steeds for talking with me this week. And you can purchase From Woolston to Colston, Severing the Sinews of Slavery in Bristol, directly from the Bristol Radical History Group website at brh.org.uk. It should already be clear, in my opinion, the book is a real achievement, both as a single source repository for information about Bristol's involvement in the slave trade, and also as a corrective to many of the facile and pernicious narratives that have retained popular currency for far too long. Sometimes I've heard people express the opinion that there is an excessive focus on slavery within broader discussions about colonialism and empire. And to that point, I'd like to quote a couple of paragraphs directly on the scale of the slave trade from the book's introduction. Quote, over a 350-year period, 1516 to 1866, it is estimated that 36,000 slave trading voyages took place, the majority of which were undertaken by the Portuguese, British, French, United States, and Spanish merchants. In all, it is estimated that 12.5 million African men, women, and children were embarked on slave ships, with about 10.7 million surviving the crossing, a death toll of 1.8 million people. To put these huge figures in context, at the height of the slave trade, around 1800, the population of the whole of the African continent has been estimated at about 90 million people. The effect of the business of slavery, particularly on West Africa, was thus immense. From 1676 to 1800, Britain was the leading transatlantic slave trading nation. In all, British ships undertook 12,000 voyages and transported 3.2 million enslaved Africans, with more than 500,000 men, women, and children dying en route. From 1698 to 1807, 2,083 slave ships left Bristol, transporting 560,000 enslaved people from Africa to the Americas. Almost 100,000 Africans died as a result. These are conservative figures for a number of reasons. First, they do not include illegal clandestine voyages or where enslaved Africans were smuggled and not officially recorded. Second, they only cover the transatlantic passage. Large numbers of enslaved people died on forced marches in Africa and after their arrival in the Americas. End quote. I'd always want to be careful in bringing up the Nazis and the Holocaust in any historical comparison. Often Nazism is used as a shorthand to signify absolute evil, the polar opposite of who we, in Britain especially, perceive ourselves to be. However, as the numbers I have just quoted make clear, in terms of a systematic degradation and dehumanisation of people based on a supposed racial difference, we have a parallel. Indeed, the term African Holocaust has been suggested by some historians as a more accurate reflection than the blandly euphemistic slave trade. Acknowledging the sheer scale of this crime against humanity is a necessary and logical first step in beginning to come to terms with the past. Debates and discussions over blame, complicity, reparations, and legacy are also necessary and have no easy answers. But I can see no cogent argument against a permanent physical monument in the city to honour and recognise the victims of slavery. That in 2020 we do not have one is an indictment on a city still in many ways afraid to confront the reality of its past. Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you enjoy the podcast, then you can give us a good review on iTunes. And if you're able to support us financially, you can do so at soundcloud.com/Bristol History Podcast. My heartfelt thanks to those who have already done so. If you have any ideas for future episodes, you can email bristolhistorypodcast@gmail.com.